Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As with many things in life, there's a lag between cause and effect in the economy. And we got a lagging economic indicator today, inflation at the wholesale level. I could give you the actual number, but here's what you really need to know. Those rising prices for pretty much everything, they're going to keep going up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at AngiesList.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 20th of May. Good to have you with us. The Labor Department keeps track of inflation for us. It's an indicator that comes in two flavors, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which in its most recent release was reasonably tame, and today's PPI, the Producer Price Index. Last month, businesses paid a little bit more for goods at the wholesale level, 0.2%, if you just gotta know. But it was the core rate that got everybody's attention. Don't count food and energy. And producers forked over an extra 0.4% last month. Let me say that one more time. Don't count food and energy. That means businesses are paying higher prices for everything else. And eventually, the rest of us will, too. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The costs of just about every commodity now in high demand are at or near record levels, and that's putting a squeeze on businesses, says Mark Zandi of Moody's Economy.com.
Given the tough economic environment, they're having a hard time passing these cost increases along to consumers. So consumer price inflation, at least outside of energy and food, has remained relatively stable and low. But that's only because these businesses have had to eat these higher costs, and it's cutting into profits, and that's why profits are down for many companies.
Without some relief, Zandi says companies will have to start cutting back and laying off workers. But the chief economist at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Martin Regalia, thinks it'll be a while before wholesale price increases start to hurt.
Profits were very, very high going into this period, and I think there's a considerable amount of leeway for businesses to absorb this. It's not something they want to do, but it's certainly something I think international competition is kind of forcing them to do.
Regalia says U.S. companies are finally getting some export advantages overseas thanks to the weak dollar. And they don't want to lose market share by raising prices. But Mark Zandi says the current trends can't last long.
If oil heads to 150 and price of wheat and soybeans and copper keeps on rising, then businesses are going to get hammered, they're going to lower jobs, and ultimately we're going to pay for it in the form of higher prices for the things that we buy.
And consumers, says Zandi, could just stop buying things if prices get too high, and that would also spell trouble for businesses. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's not $150 a barrel like Mark Zandi was just telling John, but crude nudged ever upward today. $2.02 was the gain, $129.07 was the close. A new record was had by all. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are still slugging it out over the Democratic presidential nomination. In fact, there are primaries in Oregon and Kentucky today. But the race is already over in at least one sense. John McCain and the Republican Party are going to take on the eventual Democratic winner with a lot less cash than the GOP's used to. It's an issue for McCain's campaign and for Republican congressional candidates, too. Gene Cummings writes on money and politics for Politico. Gene, good to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How big is the Republican disadvantage money-wise?
It's huge. There's a $30 million gap between Republican and Democrats so far this cycle. But what's most important is when you look at the House committees and the Senate committees, the advantages for the Democrats there are just very overwhelming, 2-1 and as much as more than 3-1.
Other than the obvious things like being able to run more ads, what does more money let the people who have it do.
They can spread the battlefield. They can go on offense in seats that they thought they couldn't afford. They can better defend seats that they thought were at risk. And on the inverse, the people without as much money, then they have to shrink, and they can only pick targeted places where they can compete. And so in some cases, they have to leave some seats completely unprotected.
Let's look at the news of the recent couple of weeks. These three Democratic wins in contested congressional elections, does that sort of bode poorly for the Republicans coming out of the fall election?
It is a really horrible sign for the Republicans, because it means that in at least these three cases, you had Republican voters voting against Republican candidates. And this is such a rarity. These districts were extraordinarily conservative. They all went overwhelmingly for Bush. They are Republican red seats. And so Republicans had to vote against their own in order for the Democrats to win. Now, that is one bad sign.
Politics is kind of a case where to the victor goes the spoils. What's going to happen after November if the Democrats pick up as many seats as they're hoping? Will they be able to perpetuate this money machine they're growing here?
They will be able to continue this kind of fundraising. In part, it's because the business community increasingly will recognize them as an entrenched majority, and so they will start doubling down on bets that they've made over the last couple of cycles. And you add to that that each cycle, the Democrats in power are expanding their own fundraising networks, and then they will be able to go back to those folks from a position in power and solicit more support. Inversely, it's much harder if you're in a minority seat and it doesn't look like you're going to be popping out of that status anytime soon, for people to figure that you are a good investment. So it makes it hard for the Republicans. So their numbers go down, Democratic numbers go up, the gap gets bigger.
Gene Cummings covers money and politics for Politico. Gene, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Turns out billionaire investor Warren Buffett's not as decisive in politics as he is in business. Buffett's over in Europe this week looking for companies there he can snap up. He said today at a press conference in Switzerland he's going to keep on throwing fundraisers for both Democratic candidates until there is finally a winner. Moving on now, it is not literally true that everybody has a cell phone, but it sure does feel like that, and it's starting to show up in the numbers, too. Sales of handsets have fallen for the first time in a couple of years. The number of new customers signing up has also taken a double-digit dive. Market saturation is part of that, of course. If everybody's got a cell phone, not so many people need a cell phone. But the slowing economy is not helping any either, and that's got the industry wondering whether anybody can hear them now. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Sales of handsets have slowed more than 20% so far this year, according to the NPD Consumer Research Group.
Well, I think the cell phone industry reflects the economy.
Jimmy Scheffler is a senior analyst with the Carmel Group. He says cell phones are in the same boat as many other consumer electronics. Customers may be looking, but they're not buying.
People who have cell phones are saying, I'm going to get along with what I've got until the economy improves. Those who are looking to upgrade, many of them are waiting.
That means cell phone companies may have to wait, too. Scheffler predicts a tough couple of years for the industry. Telecom analyst Jeff Kagan says the dropping numbers are also growing pains. He says up until now, a lot of the industry's growth has relied on people buying their first mobile phone or families expanding their plans. He says those missions have been accomplished.
We have sold 259 million phones already, and there's only about 300 million of us in the United States. At some point, you're going to run out of people to sell cell phones to.
Kagan says the down economy is dividing the market. He points to growing sales for high-end phones, like Apple's iPhone and the new BlackBerry. He attributes that to more people relying on them for work or entertainment.
10 years ago, if we had the economic tough times, customers may have just cut that expense. But today, the cell phones are not a luxury anymore. They're a necessity.
And Kagan says that's true for the younger generation, too.
Who are you texting 50 times a day?
IDK, my BFF, Jill.
In L.A., I'm SVS for MP.
The very hip Stacey Vanek Smith for us there. It's not like there's anything new you can point to that set traders selling on Wall Street today. All three major indices slipped on rising oil and worries about inflation. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to be asking three future economists a very simple question this week. Why? What drives an otherwise bright, curious, and ambitious young person to take up a discipline that's also called the dismal science? For Andra Ghent, it's because in a world full of idealists, economists are the hard-boiled truth-tellers.
The way economists see the world just makes a lot of sense to me. Economists don't actually think that people sit down with pen and paper to figure out whether the utility of eating an apple is really higher than that of eating an orange. But as Milton Friedman once said, the world sort of behaves as if we performed all these calculations. And I think this view of the world has very wide-ranging implications for everything from climate change to financial market regulation. What sort of distinguishes economists is the way we approach these social issues. We have this distinctly realist lens that we try to stick to. Too many public policy debates start from false premises about how people behave, and no matter how well-intentioned people are, the policy outcomes are going to be lousy if you start with a view about how the world should work instead of accepting how it does. Also, I think public policy tends to confuse the ends with the means of policy, and that's something most economists are extremely careful to avoid. I mean, there are reasons why economists have increasingly been researching areas traditionally dominated by other social scientists, stuff like the marriage market, education, terrorism, religion. People just find the way economists view the world and the rigor of our analysis refreshing. And our insights are often quite different than those other social scientists might come up with. I think our heavy use of mathematical modeling makes our analysis really quite precise. And at the end of the day, we can take any public policy issue, subprime, oil prices, anything really, and tell a thousand different stories. But it's good economic analysis that lets us distinguish between wishful thinking and what's actually going on in the world.
Andra Ghent recently completed her PhD at the University of California, San Diego. Let us know why you do what you do, or just what you think about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The housing market inched a step closer to salvation today. A key Senate committee approved a plan to give cheaper government-backed mortgages to as many as 500,000 borrowers. The president's still not sure if he's going to sign it, though. Meantime, one analyst said today banks are going to have to set aside another $170 billion through next year to cover all their losses on bad credit. Down at street level, the credit crunch comes in much smaller dollar amounts. Lenders are selling off thousands of houses they've foreclosed on for pennies on the dollar. And Mari Saito reports from WCPN in Cleveland, the neighborhoods those houses are in are crumbling.
Florida retiree George Petrina likes to surf eBay for good deals on piggy banks. But earlier this winter, he found a deal too good to pass up. A three-bedroom Cleveland house, opening bid $1.
This house that I bought in Cleveland, it showed that there needed cupboards in the kitchen, and it needed a sink, and that was all it showed that it needed. But, of course, I don't know, because I haven't seen the place.
I saw it. It had been broken into, and the garage was caving in. Petrina was going to fix it up and rent it out. Not anymore. This was the house's second time on eBay. The buyer before Petrina paid $2,000. The guy before that bought it from City Residential for $500. Cleveland's Regional Economic Development Director Chris Warren says lenders are selling off their worst properties to wholesalers. The wholesalers then resell the houses any way they can.
Part of the wreckage is the multitude of properties left barren, with property owners of responsible parties, so-called responsible parties, or who are unloading them from a desk in New York City. And they're doing this through the thousands of properties.
One large seller in Cleveland is City Mortgage. City bought subprime giant Argent last summer. Argent was once Cleveland's largest lender. Many of its loans have gone bad and the houses sit vacant. In a written statement, City REO says it does not sell houses in bulk, but sells off inspected houses to investors who are, quote, positioned to absorb numerous properties.
In this one, as you can see, siding's missing, windows are old, downspout's missing, it's boarded up. But if you got 500 down for 350 a month, it's yours.
Realtor Gary Kutlarczyk is showing me what the houses are like. Some investors resell the houses, often at prices 20 or 30 times what they paid for them. Kotlarczyk lives in Cleveland's Slavic Village neighborhood, an area with one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. He says houses next door are going for virtually nothing, so he and his neighbors can't get anything close to what they originally paid for their own houses.
I've had other clients who worked their whole life to have a house, to build equity for their families. They get up in their age, and then the family needs to liquidate that to pay for their expenses, and they don't have anything to liquidate. Their value's gone.
Wholesalers say they serve a purpose by putting fixer-uppers back on the market at monthly rates locals can afford. South Carolina's James Odell Barnes says he's helping investors buy 100 bank-owned properties a week in Cleveland and Detroit.
There's either got to be people like us, me and my investors, or you're going to have a whole lot more bulldozers bulldozing these houses.
Local county government is working on a land bank proposal that could hold properties banks want to offload. And City Mortgage says it's just started working on a pilot project in Cleveland that lets community development corporations get first dibs on the bank-owned houses in their neighborhoods. In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Marketplace.
Coming up, life in the slow lane with an electric car.
People buy these cars to declare their greenness, their willingness to change, their coolness.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slid 1.5% today, 199 points to close at 12,828. The NASDAQ gave up 0.9%, 23 points there, ended at 2492. The S&P 500 also lost 0.9%, 13 points, finished at 1413. Financial stocks moved lower on news that more big write-downs may be in the offing. Citigroup shares sank more than 3.75%. Goldman Sachs gave up 1%. Lehman Brothers sliced off 1.8% today. Investors nailed Home Depot after quarterly profits at the world's largest home improvement company plummeted. Shares fell 5%. Target tumbled 1.1% after the discount chain's quarterly earnings missed the mark. There was energy in energy stocks today, and I don't think we need to tell you why. Shares in ConocoPhillips and Chevron both climbed about 0.9%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.77%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The College Savings Foundation begins its summit on credit and lending issues for college students. The EPA kickstarts the 7th Annual Science Forum with a discussion on making green technologies affordable. And if you can name all the mountains, rivers, and valleys of the world, you're a prime competitor for the 20th Annual National Geographic Bee. It begins tomorrow. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've been talking a lot about rising commodity prices, food mostly, but metals have been having a boom too, and copper's one of them. It's not just prices that are hot. Increasingly, the copper itself is too. Thieves are boosting anything they can sell to scrapyards, stealing copper tubing from construction sites, that kind of thing. They're also tearing apart infrastructure, which is leaving cities and states with big repair bills when their budgets are already bleak. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
In an industrial section of Los Angeles, Ben Lozano repairs streetlights for the city.
All the wire on this particular street is gone.
Thieves yank out copper wire through utility boxes in the sidewalk. The wire from each light is worth about $20 at a scrapyard. To protect the wire, Lozano is installing new locking lids.
We'll probably be trying to replace and secure the wire that's stolen right now every day for the next, I'd say, year.
At Los Angeles City Hall, Councilman Tom Labonge reviews the damage done since last July.
Over 1,600 lights are out. It will cost over $1.25 million to fix these and repair these systems.
Nationwide, the tab runs into the hundreds of millions. In some states like Hawaii, they've cooled to copper and begun using aluminum wire. It's cheaper and less attractive to thieves. The downside is the streetlights don't burn as bright. Scott Ishikawa is spokesman for the Hawaii Department of Transportation.
When we talked to the area residents who are affected by these copper thefts, they basically said, yeah, that's fine. You know, they'd rather have some lights than no lights at all.
Darkness isn't the most serious public safety issue. When copper thieves cut power lines, they put themselves and utility workers at risk of electrocution. They also steal telephone lines, endangering anyone who needs to dial 911. Daryl Miller handles asset protection for AT&T.
It's almost at epidemic levels.
Last year, copper thefts cost the company over $6 million, and Miller says it's getting worse. So AT&T has invested in new security measures.
We've spent money in areas where we had not before relative to this issue, because one of the great challenges is our cable is everywhere. Our aerial cable spans across this country.
Helping companies like AT&T protect their assets is the silver lining to the copper crime wave.
The Department of Energy calls it a billion-dollar problem and growing, and I see that as a billion-dollar opportunity.
That's Keith Gentov with RSI Video Technologies. It manufactures wireless video cameras. Preventing metals theft is a growing part of Gentov's business. He says it could soon amount for half of his sales. Business is also booming for the $71 billion scrap recycling industry. States are passing new laws to keep hot copper out of scrapyards like this, requiring sellers to show identification, making buyers pay by check instead of cash, and photographing merchandise so it can be identified later. This car being crushed has a vehicle ID, but copper wiring rarely has distinguishing marks. Some states now require dealers to sit on inventory for days. Chuck Carr with the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, a trade group, says the law could cost dealers money.
Spot prices can change hourly and certainly daily throughout the world. It is in the best interest of the scrap industry to move material as quickly as possible.
Carr says the industry has a vested interest in stopping trade in stolen metals, since scrap dealers themselves are often victims of copper theft. Of course, it's easier to rip off a junkyard when the streetlights are out. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We have stepped outside the friendly confines of the Frank Stanton Studio to the Marketplace Automotive Test Proving Ground, otherwise known as the Garage, here at 261 South Figueroa, for another chat with our once and future car guy, Dan Neal from Los Angeles Times. Dan, good to see you.
Hi, Kai.
We were going to start this segment with you pulling up in some great car, squealing the tires and revving the engines, but we couldn't do that because of this thing you brought us today.
Yeah, this is the Zen electric car. And it doesn't squeal tires. In fact, ZEN stands for zero emission, no noise.
When I drive this home, I plug it into the outlet in the garage?
Absolutely. It has, it's a 110 household outlet.
You know what's great, by the way? The manufacturer sticker, miles per gallon city, 245.
Yeah, it's about one penny per mile to operate, but this only goes 25 miles per hour, and it's limited to streets with 35 mile per hour speed limits.
Why buy this at $15,000 now when it can only do 25 or 30 miles an hour when I can wait maybe, what, two, 3 years, spend 15 grand and get something that can go 50 and get me on the highways going to work instead of having to take surface streets and have some of the limitations that this has?
I think that gasoline is going to be $5 and $6 and inevitably $10 per gallon in the next 20 years. I think that Americans are going to have to accept a different modality when it comes to transportation. And people buy these cars to declare their greenness, their willingness to change, their coolness. Now, that isn't to say that that's in bad faith or that they're not saving money, but this is really a forward-looking kind of fashion statement.
Yeah, and on that point, actually, it's worth noting that in 2.5-inch high letters in neon green on the side of this car, it says electric.
Oh, yeah.
And then you open it up, and it's fairly bare. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah. Well, it only weighs 1,280 pounds. This is what you get when you ask for a 1,280-pound car.
So the seats are, I mean, you can see them sitting there on the little aluminum tubing. There's none of the upholstery. Well, there's upholstery,
right.
But there's none of this.
The glove box in a Mercedes-Benz S-Class is more substantial.
Let's go for a ride.
Okay.
It's a seatbelt for me.
Okay. Now it's on.
That was it. There was nothing. There was a click of the key, and that was it.
That's right.
All right, here we go.
Out on the streets of Los Angeles. We're going to go through the Second Street Tunnel here.
Yeah, now the Second Street Tunnel is usually about a 60-mile-per-hour zone.
Oh, yeah. It's speed limit's 25, though, so...
Yes, that's right. The speed limit is officially 25.
We're doing 22, 23, so this thing is almost pegged.
There you go. It's pegged now. 20.
27.
Oh, 27. Come on.
27 with an extra couple of hundred pounds.
Oh, see, it's interesting. We have some inertia.
Oh, but see, this... You hear that sound? That's me hitting the peg on the bottom of the gas pedal.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there you go. But again, it sounds like we're discrediting electric vehicles. That's not...
And it's important that not be the case, right?
Yeah, let's not discredit this technology. This is a very kind of extreme case. But electric vehicles do work, can work, they will be affordable. So this is kind of a transitional vehicle.
Yeah. The horn is on the blinker thing. So sorry. Yeah, I mean, I would think about this. Not this one, but along these lines in the next couple of years, if gas hits $5 and $6.
Yeah, if you lived in Playa del Rey or Santa Monica or Sun City, Arizona, or any big retirement community, why wouldn't you have one of these?
Right.
It will do 99% of what people want it to do and cost a penny a mile to drive. So I think it makes great sense for a lot of people.
Great sense for a lot of people, just not anybody like me who's all around three kids and a dog. We've got links to pictures of the Zen car on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which we get the official congressional response to high oil prices. Lawmakers have done plenty of posturing as pump prices have risen. Now, though, if we can't persuade them to pump more crude, well, by gosh, let's sue them. Today, the House passed legislation that would let the Justice Department sue OPEC to get more oil on the market. It's an antitrust bill, actually. It would require the oil cartel to follow the same rules American companies have to abide by. The White House says it's a bad idea and that the president would probably veto it if it got by the Senate. The House vote was 324 to 84, though, more than enough to override that promised White House veto. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rolled down 199 points on rising oil prices, 1.5%. The Nasdaq lopped off 23 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 fell 13 points, also 0.9%. Miguel Macias works the overnight shift for the Marketplace Morning Report. The Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, newspapers try to keep up.
Even when it becomes clear what a winning model will look like, don't expect that to last more than 3 or 4 years.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.